I believe we are now on the air. Hello, good evening, and welcome. My name is Samuel Trapp. You are listening to International Flavor. And I am coming to you live from Moscow, Russia, tonight, where what I really wanted to do today was spend a little bit of time talking about my impressions of Moscow now versus what they were the quite a few times that I was here between 90 and 95 when I worked as a diplomatic interpreter while I served in the Army and for the State Department. And I worked for an agency called the On-Site Inspection Agency. So if you're listening to the live podcast right now, you can absolutely click and do a call in, but I'm coming to you live from Moscow. And I've spent the day, today I did an interview with a television station here, and I had met these people in a television atmosphere last year when I traveled here to Russia to Kazan for the BRICS conference. And I was in the BRICS conference and met a good number of people that were in journalism. And at that time, I was pretty well, I don't want to say the only American here, but very, very few. There were no Americans that were in attendance in Kazan during the BRICS conference. It was really interesting to me. There was a couple of journalists, I believe they were from the New York Times, and they were together. And then there was me. And then there was one professor, what the heck was his name, that I met who was wandering around giving interviews. And then I met George Galloway from England, and he had given quite a few interviews while he was over there. And I gave a number of interviews last year, not because I'm any sort of expert or anything, or I wasn't on BRICS. I am pretty much now, or I know as much as anybody else in the West, I suppose. But at that time, it's not like I was some kind of a learned scholar. I went over there because I think BRICS is somewhat a wave of the future sort of thing, and I was very much interested in it, and so I wanted to come over and see what it was all about. So I got my travel shoes on. I got approved by the Russian foreign ministry to be in attendance, and I came over and I went to the BRICS conference last year. Well, while I was here, I met a whole good number of journalists, and while I'm here in Moscow right now, I have some interviews lined up, and I did an interview today in Russian with a Russian television station, and my Russian is good, but I'm still a little worried about having been on TV for that, because I do definitely worry about it. It's not like I prepared a whole long sort of speech that I was going to read or something. But I wanted to get to you about my impressions of Moscow now versus what they were in my younger days in the 90s. And so in the 90s, when I was over here, I was in the military. And we all had diplomatic passports, and we all wore a suit and tie, basically. And we were over here doing arms control elimination. So I was here for two programs. The first one was the INF Treaty. And the INF Treaty was the United States and the Soviet Union and then Russia getting rid of intermediate range nuclear weapons or intermediate range nuclear carriers that were capable of carrying nuclear weapons. So you hear about these ICBMs and these intercontinental missiles that are able to go a certain distance. The INF Treaty was to limit those between, I can't remember the exact number of kilometers, but I want to say 500 kilometers to 5,500 kilometers, but I could be mistaken on the upper end of that. But at any rate, those that weren't permitted to go too far. you know, your intermediate range, not your intercontinentals that would go from, that are in silos that can go from Russia to the United States without stop or vice versa. But these are the ones that I always make the joke about the Spies R Us movie with Dan Aykroyd, if you remember that, because they would see him over there, and it had something to do with one of the systems that are on the back of a large semi-tractor trailer with the rockets that go up on that. And we had, during that time period, our Pershing 1s and Pershing 2s. And that's what we were trying to get rid of. And the Russians were getting rid of their SS-20s and smaller. And so we were doing something very useful at the time in getting rid of intermediate range nuclear weapons. And now the U.S. under Trump in 2019 backed out of the INF treaty. Russia just said, couldn't have been 2 months ago, maybe less, that they were no longer going to honor it. Although after 2019, they continued to honor it on their own. But they're worried about what's going on in Ukraine right now, because now Ukrainians are starting. They bombed a factory. Oh, geez, could have been last week. It wasn't that long ago, where they claim the Ukrainians are making missiles that are in contravention of this treaty, which no longer is in effect, by the way. But that doesn't mean they want them to be manufactured next door in the country next door in Ukraine on behalf of, with German funding, by the way, in Ukraine. And so basically these are kind of big deals that they're talking about. And at any rate, years ago I was over here for those sorts of activities, and I was over here with a diplomatic passport as an interpreter for the on-site inspection agency, and later with U.S. Agency for International Development on loan to them from the U.S. military, because I was a military interpreter. And so then I would do that. Was after Russia was allegedly our friends. And so I've seen all the mistakes firsthand. I've listened to all the speaking firsthand in Russian from Putin, from everybody else. And I've seen the mistakes our own government has made. Now, I'm no certified expert from anywhere. I'm a hobbyist, and I knew what the hell I was doing back then. I know what the hell I'm doing right now. I can read a treaty. I went to law school. You know, I have a Juris Doctorate. I don't practice law anymore, but I have a doctorate. I read treaties. I've been reading them my whole life. And I know what we were supposed to do. I know what we did. And I feel that in the beginnings of all of these, we actually were doing a good thing for the world. And I think that part of what is going on in Ukraine now is due to the mistakes that we made for years. And we have made horrible mistakes ever since the 90s, ever since the Bush 1 administration, when they said, we will not go further to the east. Okay. So with that as the backdrop, I wanted to make sure that I gave my impressions of what happened. So when I came over here in the 90s, I was a pretty young man in a highly responsible position as far as, you know, I was just a sergeant in the military. I was staff sergeant. And, I loved my job. I was having a good time. And I got to come over here and see the world and see what we're doing. And it was an exciting period of time because the wall had come down. We were getting rid of the Soviet Union, the big bad wolf that was on the other side of the planet, allegedly. And things were supposed to get better, right? And when we came over here, this was after the Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. When we came over here, and I always felt like Reagan outspent all the Star Wars stuff, all of it, he outspent. They were somewhat collapsing under their own weight anyway. I'm not so sure they would have, if if Reagan hadn't have pushed. And I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent. It's history. It is what it is. I try not to say, oh, I wish this and I wish that. I try not to, because we're dealing with the realities of what is going on in the world right now. And a lot of it is due to mistakes we made, but those mistakes are already made. It doesn't do us any good to go back and wish that we had done something different. And, you know, it'd be nice if we'd had, but that's not the point of anything that I'm saying here. We are where we are, but we've made some mistakes. But if you learn from your mistakes, you can correct them. But it seems like we never do. It just seems like we have, and I'm going to pick on him again because he's such an easy target, is Lindsey Graham. We have people like him that just want to have more war everywhere. And so he's helped a lot create an enemy that is not an enemy, in my humble opinion. Okay? Now, you can call me wrong. You don't have to agree with me. But I have a pretty good grip on what Russia as a government has been saying for the last 30 years, what we said while we were making or assisting them in their collapse, what we did after that time period, what the Russians did, the horror story of the 90s for them, going through an American Depression-like time period, and then having someone like Putin pull them out, not alone, by the way, but having him pull them out of their depression-like period and change their country and change the way they felt about themselves as a country and build on something generally positive, okay? Now, can you nitpick? Sure. Can I nitpick America? I do. and I do it vocally and I'll nitpick some of Russia, what I've noticed here as well, because it's a new experience for me in Moscow. You know, last year I was in Kazan, year before I was in Nabrezhny Chelny, year before that I was in Ufa, year before that Bakirova. I've come over here quite a few years in a row in different areas, but I've never gotten to Moscow. And I've been very eager to get to Moscow because I haven't been here in so long. And so I told you a little bit in a several days ago show about my trip from Miami to Istanbul, spent the night in Istanbul, flew into Vilnius, which is in Lithuania, and then flew from took a bus. This was really cool. Took a bus from Vilnius to Minsk, Belarus, okay? And if you get your visa checked in Belarus, you're good to go in the Russian Federation, because my Russian Federation visa is good for another God knows how many months, not quite a year. And I'll have to get a new one probably when I get back this time. I'll have to get a new visa. And so which of you come in through Belarus? And then from Belarus, stayed in Belarus 5 days, 4 or 5 days, don't know. And then took a train, which was a great experience, took a train from Minsk to Moscow. And that was a cool experience. And it was a very nice train. I took a lot of pictures. I took a train several times in America. I've been on the subways in America, in Boston, and in New York. Granted, not recently. But the last time I was in the one in New York was 5 years ago, six. And it was a shit show. Pardon my French. But that's an embarrassment. You know, to have a city that big go in it's a frightening experience. And I don't mean that, you know, I'm not afraid of New York or afraid of the city, but boy, it's not pretty. And Boston, I haven't been in a Boston one since the 90s, but geez, what a dump. You get on these things and you're like, it's like riding the Greyhounds years ago. They were just crap. I took a train once from several times, from Jefferson City, Missouri to St. Louis, Missouri. That's a 2-hour train ride, you know, that's with stops and everything. Crap service, crap interior, old, crappy trains. Disgusting. You don't want to be in there. You know, it's not like it's a noble form of transport. Now, I assume that there's some positive train experiences in the United States. Okay. Infrastructure in the United States generally doesn't include, you know, of trains, you know, stuff like that. You know, we don't have any high speed rail. We don't have any, you know, decent cross country train services that take you from one state to another. Maybe in the Northeast, you know, there's some, but the ones I've been on, and I can be convinced otherwise, but I tell you what, I don't have that good of an impression. There's a reason Americans drive themselves everywhere. And it's because the infrastructure, interstate, the best infrastructure we have are the roads, you know, and they're not railroads or nothing like that. And I think we're missing the boat in some of that. So if I could start with my discussion of the metro in Moscow. So basically, we got in late at night into Moscow from Minsk. It was a, I don't know, five, six hour train ride. And it was quite comfortable. The stewardess-like girls coming in, men too, serving food. You could buy things to drink, and you could buy small food items. You know, nothing crazy. But I had some kind of an omelet that I purchased that they heated up for me and brought to me. There were sandwiches you could buy, and, you know, little snacks and whatever. Nothing crazy expensive. The prices were generally pretty good. And so then you get into crossing the border from Belarus to Russia. It's easier than us in America crossing the border from the U.S. to Canada, or vice versa, or from Mexico coming back in, okay? Or the horror story of the airport when you fly in from a foreign country, even with a fast, what do they call that? Your whatever your quick stuff is. But this was across a travel border in a train, okay? And it was nothing. Now, I was the only one checked because I was the only one on the train with an American passport. Everybody else was either from Russia or Belarus, and everybody started getting their passports out because the first stop when you crossed from, I forget the name of the city that we stopped in, but you come into the city from Minsk into Russia, and it's probably in the first hour, you know, after Minsk, and maybe hour and a half, 2 hours, that you come in the train from Minsk, and I'm, you know, sitting on a inside row. There are five chairs across, five or six chairs across each the train, you know, and I'm sitting in an aisle seat, and the train stopped. We're at the town. In walks a guy in a military uniform. Now, nobody's been in military uniforms yet. And this guy comes in, and everybody instantly sat up, and they're looking around, you know, and everybody starts digging in their bag. And he, to get their passports. And he walks up to me because, you know, they figure they're getting checked, you know, but they weren't checking anybody except me. And the guy walked up to me and he tapped me, came right up to my chair, tapped me on my shoulder and said, you know, give me your documents. And so, you know, I need to see your passport. So I got my passport out. He checked it all out. He didn't ask one question, didn't ask anything, handed it back to me. And that was it. And then he turned around and left the train. He didn't check anybody else. He was only checking me. And I'm assuming it's because I was from America. Now, same thing, not the same thing, but when I came across on the bus, because when I came into Belarus from Lithuania, there it was you have to get off and drag, do a bag drag. You got to drag all your bags across the entry point as well. And so when I came into Minsk, into Belarus, there, you know, I'm coming in from a Western country and into an Eastern country, one that is subject to Russian. Belarus isn't subject to Russian anything, but they honor Russian visas. But if you get checked by a Russian or by a Belarus border guard, it counts for getting into Russia, obviously, because that's what happened. And when I came in, I was there, did the bag drag, and got into the there was a big line because everybody off the bus was dragging their crap through the checkpoint. And you get off and I come up to a young girl in a window and hand her my passport. And she kind of looks at me like, who the hell are you? And, oh, geez, you know, one of those things like, why me kind of thing. And she doesn't ask me any real question, where are you going? You know, she said, how long are you going to be in town? And then she asked a question. She said, do you need to register? And I said, well, I don't know. Now, registration, I've registered before. When I come into Russia, if you stay somewhere longer than a certain period of time, and I believe that period of time, I could be mistaken in the amount of time, but I believe that period of time has been explained to me as 14 days. That if you're going to be there longer than 14 days, you have to register with the local, like police, local authorities, local services. And so I have, of course, and usually that is the requirement of whatever hotel service, or usually I'm in a private apartment somewhere, you know, that I rent for the time period. And that person who owns the apartment has to register you, so they take a copy of your passport and they can take a copy of all of that. Well, I don't know the rules in Belarus. I just knew that my visa was good. So I expected she would tell me whether or not I had to register or anything like that, but she never did. She asked me, do you have to register? And I'm like, well, I don't know. You know, you got me. And all this is going on in Russian anyway. And she said, she just looked at me for a while, like quite a while, a couple, 3 minutes. No more questions. She just kind of stared at me, stared at my passport, stamped it, handed it back to me, and let me go. And I don't know, you know, I was checked by a border guard. I know the law in America, and the law in America is if you are checked by a border guard, you are legal. Okay? So that's how it happens. And then you get checked by that border guard. You're suddenly, if you've come in, you're granted permission to be there by the executive branch of government. They've allowed you to come in. Even if you're an alleged illegal, if they allow you in, you came in legally. Now, if you stay longer than what your visitor visa allows you, you become illegal after that. And so the same thing happens in other countries. If you get checked at the border, they put that stamp in your passport, you're legal. And you have to comply with all the laws and say, you can't stay longer than this amount of time, that amount of time, whatever it is. Well, for me, mine says I can't stay longer in Russia than 6 months at a time under the rules that I am under, and I wouldn't anyway. You know, the longest I've ever stayed was six weeks, I think it was, traveling around. I've done that twice, traveling around Vladikavkaz area last year, and then a couple of years before being in Tatarstan for that long a period of time. And beautiful parts of the country. Anyway, that's how the that is how the visa scenario, passport scenario works. Okay, and it that is how I got in. But when I came in to Russia, that's how I was checked in to get into Russia. And so you come across on this six-hour train ride into Moscow. That night, you come into a big train station. There's no real verification of anything. You just get off the train like you would in any American city, doing the same thing. You get out, and you then have to figure out how to get to the place where your apartment is. Well, there had been some bad news about our apartment, and this I thought was a little bit of a, I don't know whether to call it a scam or a something irregular, let's call it that. And this is the first time this sort of thing has happened. And had gotten an apartment through a service. And on the train into Russia, received notice that the apartment was not going to be available and was offered a different apartment in a different area of the city, a quite different area of the city, farther away, quite a bit farther away. And but it's all, you know, still metro line line, you know, you got a 10 minute, according to the host, you have a 10 minute walk to the metro, and then you get on the metro and you can go anywhere in the city. They have a great metro system. Now, the metro system I wanted to talk about quite a bit of, and that was my first impression getting in the metro and trying to remember what it was like. I remember the Moscow metro from the 90s being worse than the metro of Boston. And that was a shit show. Okay. And I remember Moscow being just frighteningly nasty. Okay. And I could tell you some stories about that. It was dirty. It was stinky. It was scary. It was damp. Perhaps I was in the one bad area of town, but I don't think so, because they still had a pretty good metro system even back then. But when we came in on the train from Minsk, Belarus, and came across the border, the train was great, the train was clean, and we pulled into a great big station, did the bag drag, and went around across a couple of rails, and suddenly you're in the underground metro system. Okay? And the difference between the 90s and now is astronomical. It is a metro system to be proud of. It is clean. It is professional. It is modern. They're rebuilding different areas in different parts. They have escalators that go huge distances, like way up. You're on the escalator for several minutes. You're on the escalator that take you up to the next place. The tunnels and paths and guards everywhere and professional people. And then when you get on the subway themselves, I have some pictures and some photos that I would like to upload, and I'll try to at some point to upload them to make sure that they are well put, you know, so that we can hear them or see them and listen, because it's they're quiet, they're not crazy loud, they're not, people are not rude, they have these announcements that come up pretty regular, like on the ones you hear in New York or in Boston. Next station, Tretiakovsky. You know, please stand away from the doors and blah blah blah. You know, that kind of thing, and be safe, right? And give up the chair to older people, that kind of stuff, or to people that are pregnant or whatever, and that they say some of those things. And they have a cool app that you can download and follow your progress and say, I need to go from here to here, because it is quite the system of underground maps. And so we basically had to get off of the train, get onto a metro system train, go underground, and take three separate legs on three different lines. It was a green line, a purple line, and a gray line, something like that. And a total of 20-something stops, right, that you had to go and get on. But it was easy to follow. It cost 74 rubles, which in a dollar, there are 80 rubles, plus or minus. You know, sometimes it goes as low as 75. A year ago, it was up to 100 and something. So for basically 90 cents, you can go from the center of town to the far part of town with, you know, one swipe of your bank card and 74 rubles is what it cost. And bring all your luggage, bring all your stuff, because we had gotten off train, right? So everybody's doing the suitcase drag, right? And so that part was a little less than desirable, dragging suitcases through that stuff, because, you know, if you're pulling a suitcase through an escalator, is kind of a pain in the ass. But either way, it was certainly no problem in a clean and non-stinky, non-damp, non-frightening environment of the Moscow Metro, and professionals everywhere. There's a lot of railroad and metro workers that are present. There are, in certain places, there are some military people, but there are people, there are plenty of workers around, you know, and during all the time. And nobody messes with anybody. And I've gone all hours of the night. And so the metro was quite clean. Now, I'm going to continue the story for when we get to this apartment that we were getting into. And the apartment's a two-bedroom apartment, one bath, small kitchen, on the first floor of a building. And the first impression was, and sometimes the buildings outside are, I don't think as much attention is paid as in an apartment complex in America would pay to keeping track of the outside In America, they want to keep track of everything on the outside. In the inside, it can be as big a dump as you need it to be, right? Or wherever people live, you know, then that's up to the individual person. But outside, they want it to be, you know, some kind of a facade of what it looks like. I've found the opposite to be true for the most part in Russia, that the common areas, although clean, although well taken care of, and all well presented, are not as well cared for, not as frequently cared for, mowed, flowers, you know, stuff like that. And it's like each building doesn't really have their own association of people that'll clean it. It's up to you to do something like that. And people don't. And they don't keep track of the common areas. But when you get into the apartment itself is usually very, very nice. Sometimes they're old, but extremely well cared for and decorated. And if people are going to, you know, kind of Airbnb, I suppose you'd call it, their place in Russia, it better be in good shape, right? Well, I was pretty worried about this one because we were left waiting. We got conflicting signals, got you better get here now or we're not going to wait. And then when we got there, it was like, oh, it's not ready yet. It'll be ready in a little bit. You can't come in. The code didn't work. I mean, this is the first time this has happened to me in Russia. And I was afraid that it was going to be something horror story. It turned out it's a decent apartment. It's on the first floor, and I believe there's been some kind of a musty event in this entire building before. Maybe it's the season of the year. Maybe the building itself doesn't have as good a ventilation, and the building on the outside has the date 1969 as the year the building was built. And so, but inside, it's well presented, it's decently kept, it just has that musty smell, right? And so the musty smell I'm definitely against. Although there are ways to deal with that. But it seems like there's just some dampness here that otherwise wouldn't be or shouldn't have been. And so, at any rate, I don't know why I included that part because I want to focus mainly on Moscow itself, but it is all part of the trip and how it's gone so far. So, the price, though, is, think about this, for 6 nights, yeah, I believe by the time it gets all worked out, 6 nights in Moscow turned out to be, I'm going to calculate it real quick so I don't get it wrong. Because I want to know, I've been meaning to do it myself anyway, to tell you how much the number is for that amount of time. And so, basically, a 2-bedroom apartment of someone's is costing me $40 a night. $40 a night in Moscow. Okay. Private apartment, decent size, 2 king, but queenish, little larger beds. 1 bathroom, includes a washer. They don't do dryers in Russia. That's a different story for another day. And a small kitchen. And, so the other thing you notice when you come and you get to apartments, especially the new ones, and if you stay in a brand new apartment in Russia, you're really in for a treat because What they try to do is they're building, there's huge construction everywhere. Belarus and Russia, or Belarus, why do I keep calling it Belarus? It's called Belarus and Russia, have huge construction projects, especially in apartment complexes and things like that. And when they build them, they're 20 stories high, you know, and the bottom floor is set for shops. And so you'll have coffee shops and mini marts and hair places, fingernails, another coffee shop, you know, whatever, small businesses on the first floor. And then, and you know, 10 buildings in an apartment complex and hundreds of people, hundreds of families living in the buildings. And then on the first floor, you'll have all of these places where you can go and do your quick shopping, right? And so that is highly desirable. And in America, it seems like we, you know, everywhere we have to go, you have to drive, okay? Not so, although there's plenty of cars in Russia. Here, you can get places without having a car. Now, I've never lived officially in a big city like New York. I lived in Washington, D.C. in the suburbs, and I rode my bike everywhere when I was a kid. But I would never take the bus system. I've never been a big bus sort of person. I don't want to do that. I'll take a bus from city to city, but I don't want to get on a bus to go to work, you know, or I could handle a subway, you know, I could handle a train, you know, those I would be okay with, especially if it was in as good a condition as the one I've seen here in Moscow. This was pretty impressive, okay? And I'd like to put up some photos and videos of this. At any rate, so for the equivalent of $40 a night, you can stay in a nice place. The food costs nothing. The transport costs nothing. Food, let's see. For probably $10, you can have a nice, very nice lunch. You know, a tea or coffee, a bottle of water, a soup, some pilmeni, and all that costs you, you know, $6 or something, $7. And if you there are expensive restaurants too, and you can go to some of those, but even those here are not horror story expensive. Belarus was expensive. Okay, Belarus, they're very, very proud of it. And I think there's something, whenever you get to the Europeans, you end up spending a hell of a lot more money. I don't know why, but Europeans are extremely expensive to travel in Europe. Not so to travel in Russia or any former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan. Those were very, very inexpensive. And I think I've already told those stories in the last year or so, a couple of years. At any rate, the day yesterday was spent on the metro, going on a boat ride. Now get this, the Moscow Metro has introduced a method. So the trains, the buses, the subways are all connected. So around the city, you get on these lines, it's one fee. You pay one fee in the metro. It takes you onto the train, onto the bus, and around for this anywhere in the city from point A to point B, basically, costs you this 74 rubles, less than a dollar. And you can be on the train for an hour to get from, you know, one part of today I went a total of 14 stops on a train. That took 40 minutes, and then another 15-minute segment on the metro. If you had to drive all of that, it would take you an hour and a half. But you can go from point A to point B in the whole city. I did it in like an hour. And it's faster. It's definitely cheaper. And, you know, very little stress, very little worry that you're not going to make it. But a system this big has always got its share of repairs going on, and you can't get off at this stop because they're repairing the escalator, going to wherever. Or when I got interviewed today, because I got interviewed by that TV station in Russian today, when they were giving me directions, they said, when you get off the subway at Tretyakovskaya, then we will meet you there, because one of the escalators is out and we don't want to have to explain that to you. So we'll just come meet you there and walk you to our building, you know, four or five minutes away, which is exactly what they did. So I get off the subway and there were two young ladies there to meet me and walk me to the building and to the studio where we were going to do the interview, which is actually really cool. And they met me and we chatted and, you know, very nice. Do you want to stop, get coffee? You do this and you do that. But very clean, very professional, very well run. And everywhere you go into a coffee shop, you go into a bar, you go into a restaurant or any sort of gift shop that is just extremely clean, very well presented. The people are very nice. It's, I always say, everybody in Russia is the same as in any nice American town. The people are people. People are fantastic. And the people are, you know, each going about their own lives in the best way they can, trying to make money for themselves and their families and whatever it is they do in their free time, whatever hobbies they like to have. And the Russians are no different than us. In fact, you can see their families, their, you know, on the subways, a husband and wife will get on, 2-3 kids, well-dressed, well-presented. Everybody dresses up. You have your share of people with, you know, body piercings and tattoos like you do in America? Yes, you do. Do you have your share of conservative people that are well-dressed and, you know, wouldn't wear a shirt with a tear in it ever? You have plenty of those. And then you have the people who intentionally tear their jeans and tear their stuff just like we do in America. It is so American that, you know, there are Burger Kings everywhere. And you can get, there are Burger Kings, there's coffees, there's, and it's all of the same things that you have in America, you have in Moscow. Sometimes I feel like the quality is just poof, a little bit higher, a little bit better, a little bit of a higher standard. Nothing dramatic, but I don't know how to explain it quite right, but they're very proud. I mean, just like we are in America, we're proud as well. And it's very nice to be associated and to, when I speak to people in Russian, they are just in shock. Today, I had, for example, one of the problems I had to go to the bank, right? I had to go to the bank, and because you can't spend, you can't spend dollars in Russia. You can't use your American Visa or MasterCard or American Express in Russia. That ended several years ago when the war started with Ukraine and the sanctions and all took effect. So the first time I really had issues with it was last year. This year, I thought I might have gotten around it. Okay. So I had brought a small amount of money. I don't, you know, it doesn't take a lot to be here, but I brought a small amount of money. And when I was in Belarus, I had to get Belarus rubles. And the Belarus ruble is not the Russian ruble. And I had to, but in Belarus, your Visa and your MasterCard will work. So I got a number of Belarusian notes out of the ATM because I thought that you, because I had been told this was the case, that you could spend Belarusian rubles in Russia or trade them in Russia. So if I was getting some back then, trading in my dollars, I could have the Belarusian and then get into Russia and turn them into Russian rubles instead of Belarus rubles, right? And however, important safety tip, if you're ever doing what I did, you cannot do that. That is not the way to go because, and if you've ever done it before, you already knew that. Somebody could have explained it to me, but it wasn't well explained and you couldn't really find it. And I had been misled that you can swap them because you cannot. So when I came over here, I don't have any dollars left. I'd traded them all into Belarusian or Belarus rubles. So, but I had a card from last year, kind of like a Cash App card for Russia. And it's given by a bank. In this case, you know, it's given by a bank. And you just put money on that card. And that card doesn't expire for 10, 12 years or whatever. And you put your cash on it so you don't have to carry cash. Well, last year when I was here, in Kazan, I had put some cash on a card, didn't spend it all. So I had a little bit still left on this card. And so, you know, I was going to use that and take my Russian or my American money or my Belarus money and put it on this card too. So I wouldn't have to carry cash around, right? And so this morning, I was going to get that done. So I go to a bank. I go to the bank that gave me my card. I tried to do this in Belarus, by the way. So in Belarus, I went to a bank of the same name, and I went to that bank, and I said, okay, I have a card from Russia. I want to take some money out of my bank in the United States and put it on this Russian card here. Nope, you can't do it, even in Belarus. And I said, well, why can't you do that? They said, because this bank is a Russian bank, and the Russian bank is sanctioned. I said, yeah, but you're sanctioned in Belarus too? They said, well, we can still, you know, do business here, and we can trade, but we can't use your Visa MasterCard. So in order for it to work, you'll have to go to another bank in Belarus or an ATM, which you don't want to do, because if you take cash out of the ATM, they take some huge ungodly percent, whatever private owner of that ATM does. And if you take out $300-$400, costs you $100 in freaking fees to take it out, which is nonsense. So you want to take it out of your bank. Well, I thought I had a bank. Come to find out, I didn't. And, well, I do, but actually all I have is a bank card, but with like a Cash App card. Anyway, long and short of that is, the people in Belarus told me, nope, you have to do that in Russia. So take your Belarus rubles to Russia and trade them in. So this morning, I go to the bank in Russian bank and present my Belarus rubles. And say, I want to add these to this card. They said, get this, they said, we don't accept Belarus rubles. I said, what the hell am I supposed to do with these then? And how the hell am I going to survive? Because I can't get any cash out of the bank from you. I only have a little bit left on, you know, whatever small amount I had from last year left on this card. And I can't add anything to it. And I have no dollars. I can't get any dollars because all I have is these Belarus rubles that I already traded my dollars for, and now you tell me I can't put the Belarus rubles into a rubles bank. I thought you were friends with Belarus. Well, no, we are. But this bank doesn't take your Belarus rubles. You're going to have to find a exchange, a money exchange. And there's places where they are, you know, center of Moscow. I found several of them. And so that is what I had. I spent a little bit of time doing that nonsense today, trying to figure out, because of sanctions that we have put against Russia, their system is somewhat isolated. For me, I didn't have, I mean, I've never had a huge problem with it, even last year when it first hit me last year that the sanctions were going to kick my butt, because even after the war had started, they hadn't taken away the ability to use a Visa or MasterCard. You didn't have to get a Russian Mir card in order to be able to pay for things and not carry cash everywhere. Now, there's still quite a few people that carry cash and use everything for cash anyway, just like in American society. But I didn't want to, as a traveler, in the event something did go wrong, I did not wish to be carrying around a truckload, even a small amount of cash. I'd rather have a card. You can shut off a card if somebody steals it and get your money back for the most part. And there's insurance for that sort of thing when you're traveling, especially. And even on the Russian side, they have the same sort of protections that we do on the Visa MasterCard side. So, at any rate, now I'm sitting there really sweating it. What the hell am I going to do, even though I'm only here 6 days? You know, what am I going to do? So, but I did find a money exchange service. I paid a little bit for it, but not the crazy amount that you would have had to do to withdraw the money from the bank originally. So that all worked out pretty well. So, probably a long story to tell everybody that, you know, this is how, these are some of the problems that we have created for our own people traveling. This does not create a problem for the Russians, okay? They, you know, use Russian banks anyway. They can freely come the other direction. Well, maybe not so freely, but they can, you know, their travel is free as ours. We don't give any of them visas. But if they were in our country, they could get a credit card, you know, and they could use their Visa MasterCard. But now they had to start this Mir program. Nobody uses the Mir card, but they're starting to be used in places like China, India. They're starting to have changes accepting those cards and creating an alternative system to SWIFT and to the acceptance of the Visa MasterCard system. I've heard that the Mir card is accepted in a few places, even in America. And Mir means peace and world. You know, both of them are the same word in Russian. And so, but I hear that there are places that you can use the Mir card in, like New York, Houston, you know, wherever there are embassies and consulates of Russia. And maybe some other places too. I don't know, San Francisco. But I've heard, I can't verify that, but I do know that you cannot use your MasterCard or Visa in Russia. So far, that's a no-go. And maybe there's something. I was wondering if the embassy, if you had any problems. But the embassies and the consulates are mostly closed or very, very limited staff, and certainly no citizen services, if you want to call it that, that are there. So at any rate, I've wandered around quite a bit from my original. Let's talk about the look at the metro systems, train systems, transportation system in general. Extremely impressive. The cleanliness, the modernization of it all has been pretty damn outstanding. And so my impressions are quite naturally quite high on that end. It's also very high on the food end. Everybody knows I like food. Everybody knows I like Uzbeki food. And there are plenty of Uzbeki restaurants here. There are plenty of, you know, I like my coffee in the morning. Getting a coffee shop here, I mean, geez, you get a coffee, and I don't usually eat a whole lot of breakfast, but I'll get a cappuccino or a latte or something like that, and have that for breakfast. And very cheap, couple of bucks, and you can have a mini breakfast, you know, with a coffee and stuff. And then the transportation costs nothing, the food costs nothing, and there are plenty of sights to see. Told you a little bit in my past show about the history and whatnot of some of the things that I like to see. I got to go to Brest when we were in Belarus, and that is an ancient city. The tour guide was telling us that 1015, the year 1015, 1015, is the earliest reference to the city of Brest, which is on the border of Belarus and Poland. And quite a history of being overrun back and forth, which is a lot of European territory in this area, you know. And when you think about Ukraine, of all places, think Belarus too, the entire part of Europe that we are talking about, from Moscow down to Turkey, from Turkey across to maybe not quite as far as Spain, but Spain was included too, all the way up through Europe and across to Poland and Moscow and all of that. All of that entire area over the last 1,000 years has been subject to kings, to monarchies, to war, to overthrow, to tyranny, to government actors, and plenty of colonization. Huge amounts. And so the history that you see in a place like Brest was unbelievable, first of all. And in America, it's possible that we don't quite understand that because we've not been overrun. We did the overrunning, got rid of the Indians. They may have overrun each other. If they were still around, maybe they would be closer to what the Europeans are. But because we basically exterminated the Indian nations when the white man came along, that doesn't exist for us. There's been no, you know, hundreds and hundreds and, well, thousands of years of war between Canada, Mexico, and the United States, you know, and we have dominated that relationship between the rest of the Western Hemisphere to such an extent that these sort of things have never happened. But on the other side of the planet, especially in Europe, especially in the areas that we are talking about, especially in Ukraine, all the way up through Belarus, I mean, think about it. Mongolian hordes, Turkish Empire, Ottoman Empire, Austria-Hungary, Germany, Germany in World War I, Germany again in World War II, Russia going westward to a lot of those places. It's, I don't want to say it's been, a constant, but I believe there's such a thing as a national memory. Certainly, nobody is left, or extremely few people are still alive from the Poland years when the Ukrainian Banderovs, which were aligned with the Hitlerites, the Hitler regime, and killed on behalf of the Hitler regime 100,000 to 120,000 Poles inside of Western Ukraine. A man named Stepan Bandera did that, and he's revered by Ukraine. You know, and he definitely participated in the extermination of the Poles. Well, they remember that, and in the back of their brains, and I think this is in the back of everyone's brain that is a European, is that somehow, somewhere, their family in the background has been destroyed, you know, family being the national family has probably been damaged by some of these processes. So that will now take place from the side of Ukraine against Russia, as in Russia is, you know, consistently forcing us on these, you know, on these ends, and has tormented us. Well, the story of Brest and the people coming back and forth across those, I just want to make sure that people understand that the entire area has been overrun for at least 1,000 years. Okay. And I think that you get a good amount of history examination and the saving of historic relics and items that in America we don't have. Okay? Well, I mean, we have them, but obviously they're nowhere near as old. When you're going down the Volga River on a boat in Russia and you see this enormous statue of Nicholas the First. Wow, that was impressive. And when you see the gates of the Kremlin or St. Basil's Cathedral or any of those things, you can't help but be moved by it, by the sheer history of it all. And there is plenty of it in numerous places. Everywhere you go, there's a Pravoslavyanska church, Orthodox Russian Orthodox church somewhere. I have a habit of asking for directions. You know, I finally learned my lesson, especially that's the other thing that doesn't work, by the way, here, is getting a phone. They changed the rules on getting phones. I have to go down this pathway because you want to hear about life, how it's really like in Russia, yes? And if you're going to pay attention to this or something that is different for an American, Okay, if I'm in America and I want to get a phone, I go to T-Mobile, I go to AT&T, I go to wherever, and I get a phone. I sign up for a service. Hell, they'll give me the phone and just bill it to me along with the service. Okay? When I was here last year, I got a Russian phone number, and I paid for it for 3 months. I said, you buy this phone, you get a SIM card, and it'll last you for 3 months. Here's your number. And what I wanted to do, but it was too late because I was already back in the States, is before I left, I wanted to make that number, pay whatever cost it was per month. Very minor, nothing major at all. Their unlimited internet plan for in Russia, their unlimited phone plan is something like 500 or 600 rubles. And remember, there's 80 rubles to the dollar, so it's like 10 bucks. It's nothing crazy. And you can't use it out of the country, of course. But, you can, but the prices will be dramatically different. But inside the country, you can use it. Well, I had gotten this phone, and I wanted to use it because mine was intermittent from America. Just wasn't doing what it needed to be doing. And the stability of the internet was off quite a bit, right? And so I got this number. Well, my hope was today to be able to go into the phone company and just renew that same number and keep that number. But in the worst case scenario, I would just get a different number. So today, after quite a bit of looking around, trying to find one that was open, I went to one today that was closed, and it said it was closed because they were doing an inventory. So they were closed. I went to another one. That one was closed because they were, what was that one doing? Remodeling or something. There was some kind of remodeling going on. And then when I finally get to the third one, that guy says, well, I wish I could help you, but I can't. They have changed the rules. You're a foreigner. I was like, yeah. He said, you can't have a phone without filling out all of these documents, and you have to go to the government services and get a government services permit and get, and then you bring it back here, and then we give you a phone, and then you take that phone number back to the government service people, and they verify that it's you and your number and your phone. I said, okay, well, how do I do that? They said, here's the list of places you can go. There's a place called My Documents. And My Documents has locations all over Russia. And it's basically the ID pass, the DMV, if you will, of Russia. And you go to those places and get your government services. New passport, you go here. New driver's license, you go here. New apartment that you got to buy in a certain location, you go here. So it's your courthouse, all in one, any sort of government services, and you go get your documents. And now, as a non-citizen, you still have a non-citizen go in and take care of your getting a telephone number. I was like, oh, geez. I was like, can I get that done in a week? He goes, well, you'll have to check with them in that regard. So I say, okay. Get to the phone company and, or to the My Documents place anyway. Get in a line and wait for that one. I get to the front of that. The lady says, we don't do that at this location. And I'd spent a good amount of time finding this place. She handed me a list of places that said, here's a list of places where they do handle that, you'll have to go to one of them. So I say, okay. I get out. I find the closest one. My phone isn't working because my internet is spotty. And so I wander around circles for a while, try to find the right spot. Get to the right spot, go to the new My Documents place. And in the new My Documents place, I wait in line for 10, 20 minutes in the line of foreigners waiting for foreigner services. And I get to the front and I say, listen, I don't have a phone. I do, but I need a Russian SIM card. And I have one from last year, but they won't activate it without me getting governmental services. What can I do? She says, do you have all your documents? I said, well, I'm not sure what documents you need. She said, well, we need a copy of your passport. I said, well, I have my passport here. She says, no. It needs to be translated into Russian. You have to go see a translator, translate it into Russian, bring me this document. She gave me a list of crap I had to do in order to get this phone number. And last year, it took nothing. It's just like, you know, it was a simpler process than going to T-Mobile or AT&T and buying a phone. You just go in and you buy it, and that's that. And now, I was like, seriously? I said, well, why is this? And she said the same thing. It's because of there's a lot of trickery going on over the telephone. People from India, people from Russia, and they want to be able to track these people, and they have their phones. And so that is why I thought it was just anti-America. First, for some reason, I was thinking, because the guy had said to me, you're an American, you're going to have to do this. And I was like, well, that's kind of irritating, but I get it, you know. And so then, come to find out, it's not just Americans, it's everybody that is a foreigner, that is coming to, especially trickery. Again, and apparently, and I've read quite a few articles about it. I think I shared one with you late last week about they're sending some old pensioners. They're trying to figure out how to steal their money, and they talk them into stuff over the telephone, into giving up their passwords and their information. And then they steal all their money, and then they have them do things on behalf of the Ukrainian government. There's been quite a few stories of this that have been going on. That is, you know, somewhat frightening. So I'm not against the fact that you have to do these things to go and get a telephone, but then again, you know, it's like you're punishing the rest of the population because of the few group, you know, of tricksters. I'm not a trickster that's going to call people and call old people and steal their money and then have them do weird things in an effort to get it back, like deliver bombs, which is what there's been a couple of articles about, people trying to deliver weapons to military, to blow up military cars and stuff like that. There's been some pretty bad stories. So I get the need for security, and I, especially in today's world, and I get the need for keeping track of who has a phone. You know, in America, and on my damn radio show, and I know that we have a damn radio, there's a guy who calls and has like 6 or 7 different numbers. And, he likes to be able to get through and talk to you. But he never has anything nice to say. He's always very negative. And I never, ever understood that. So I don't accept his calls anymore either when he calls in. But apparently that's why the rules regarding phone system have changed in Moscow. And well, maybe Russia-wide, I presume, would be, in effect, Russia-wide instead of, you know, just Moscow. But I didn't ask that question. I just presumed it. So, at any rate, back to the metro stations and the cool part of all of that. I believe I've given you the highly positive regard of what has gone on from my point of view, especially with relation to the metro stations and the public transportation in Moscow. The other thing is the sheer beauty of it all. And in a place where, you know, however many millions of people live in Moscow, it's, I remember coming in on the train from Belarus in the early evening and passing a few places where there was, you know, plenty of graffiti along the side of the, you know, traveling as you were coming in by train. There was plenty of that, but no different than any other city. But I don't want you to say that there's nothing there, but there's also a lot of people engaged in cleaning, street sweepers, guys that are picking up in parks, trash guys inside the subway systems, inside the rail systems, and all of that type of thing. They are nearly always visible. They, I believe, spend a good amount of effort and money trying to keep things clean and presentable. Another thing that you don't see a lot of is trash cans. And I think that people tend to keep their trash themselves and throw it away at home on their own. They don't go out searching for trash cans. You know, they're I don't want to say they're hard to find, because they're not, but they're very small. It's not like they're going to be big and, you know, obtrusive and everywhere, because they aren't. And sometimes you got to look around to find them. Like if you buy a coffee to go and you're wandering down the street with your empty coffee cup, and your coffee cup not only can go, it is gone. And you're carrying around an empty cup. Sometimes it's difficult to find a place to throw that cup away. And it's part of the reason, I think, that they must, because you don't see crap all over the streets and the sidewalks. And I have seen, and have done it myself, but I have seen other people pick up trash that wasn't theirs and drop it in a receptacle. You know, pick it up and drop it somewhere. The place is generally clean. There's plenty of old places that are falling apart. You know, it's an aging city. The city is freaking old. And there are parts of the city, you know, every city's going to have a regeneration, whatever number of years, whatever periods of time that take place. And I believe that Russia happens to be in one, or has just had one, especially with the metro system. The metro system is fantastic. I want to point out that I am a patriot for America. I love my country as well. And my goals are to make sure that people understand that Russia is not the enemy of America. And I believe that we have, and they're not the enemy of Europe either. I believe that we have created that enemy, that the people, on the basic level, are not your enemy. America, they are not your enemy. Europe, they are not your enemy. Canada, or anywhere else that is involved in any of the war in Ukraine and they have been given a bad rap, let's call it that. We all need to take a step back from the information that has been provided us. I hope that my discussions on these topics with you are helpful in that regard. I wanted to point out that there are plenty of other sources, not just me, but that if you get the chance, Russia is a very large and very beautiful country with a lot to offer, and the systems and people are very good, and they treat you well. They will take care of you. I haven't even begun to get into the sanatoriums far enough yet, although I have talked about them in previous episodes, previous podcasts, and perhaps you could go back and listen to some of those when you get to them. And it is certainly worthy of the effort. Now, I pointed out to you before that Belarus was country number 57 for me to visit. Or I could be wrong. It may have only been 56. I don't remember the true numbers. But I'll have to go back and revisit that. Maybe it's 56. And I don't remember. But at any rate, in having a different perspective is very important to have a look at some of these. And these countries are worthy of a strong consideration for a visit, especially because you get a lot of money's worth, a lot of money value to your vacation, to your trip. And it is well worth the effort for you to come along. So my name is Samuel Trapp. You are listening to International Flavor on Dam Radio. I am live every night, Sunday through Thursday, from 9 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. Chicago time. You can listen to that live at damradio.com/live. Want to put a plug in for our other shows on Dam Radio, many of which are also quite politically challenged as well. And those you can get at damradio.com/schedule. You can listen to this podcast and all the other Dam Radio podcasts at damradio.com/podcast, and you will get the latest episodes, plus you can search them all. For me, I have a Russian-speaking channel on YouTube, which is YouTube at Samuel Trapp is my channel. And you can go there and listen to the Russian versions of a lot of the same things that I talk about on International Flavor. And you can go to internationalflavor.com and listen where you're listening live now, probably. Or you can get all my prior podcasts at internationalflavor.com. And I very much look forward to having you come again in the future. Have a good night.